Welcome to ITE 1, Module 8.
I'm going to need to... I'm realizing the number pad on my laptop embedded netbook thing doesn't let me do some of the NVDA stuff either, so I'm going to have to play with the laptop keyboard layout.
Is that a 64-bit operating system, Sean?
No, it's 32 gig, or 32-bit. It's a netbook.
Boy, I'm looking at a new computer for my wife, Holly, and it seems like everything I see is 64. It's almost hard. It's so hard to seem to find a 32-bit, I guess, because it's everything's taken so much RAM.
There is a point, though. Windows actually comes with the 32-bit and the 64-bit install media. So all you have to do is load the 32-bit onto the 64-bit machine. To be honest, if you're running Office and standard applications, you shouldn't have a problem with 64-bit. It's only if you're cracking JAWS that 64-bit's a problem.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was
thinking.
Or
if you have really bizarre device drivers that... really bizarre devices that won't work with 64-bit that don't have 64-bit drivers. So guess what probably wouldn't work? Your dear sacred double talk PCI probably would not work.
Oh, no, it wouldn't.
No, but I think I have a friend. It wouldn't be for me. It's not my machine, but eventually I'll upgrade to one. But I think I have a friend that's got a 64-bit machine that's running a triple talk USB, but I'm not sure if that's his 64 or 32, but he's got two different ones.
No, USB is different. If you've got a USB, that's a different kettle of fish because it comes up as like a USB serial port and the drivers talk to it that way. But if you've got an internal PCI card, you've got to have a 64-bit driver for the PCI card.
Yeah, I think so. I think he actually did have to write some new drivers for something. No, Mike's lazy over there. I still say it's some of the best speech out there. I've always liked it.
Oh, I liked it on my book port.
It gave me headaches for the first 4 hours of using it. All of the noises in the preamp. It's like, guys, you couldn't have cleaned that up? Ah, no, we really are on a budget.
Deck Talks was pretty bad, too.
Mm-hmm, it was.
The transport never did that.
I had a sound card I could use it with, and when I did broadcasting, and you could hear, it sounded like a printer. You could hear the stuff through the serial port coming through the sound card. It was awful.
That was my way. If I didn't have an AM radio handy, I'd listen to the Deck Talk to listen to the computer booting.
All right, guys.
Up, so I didn't know what it was doing.
Lecture theater.
Welcome to ITE 1, Module 8. This module is on networking. So today we're going to have a pretty heavy networking lecture. There's a lot of terms, a lot of concepts to understand. If you really like this kind of stuff, or think you might be interested in doing this, you would probably enjoy either discovery or exploration. And if you want to do either of those next term, they should both be offered. And you will have a couple of new instructors for discovery, and you will get to have Carrie as your exploration teacher, if that is something you are interested in. Both courses are taught completely differently to this one. This is a very simple yet full of information little module, and presented differently than any other course presents it. So this is networking the IT essentials way.
If you liken information technology to an ice cream parlor, ITE1 is like the course where you've got like 37 flavors in your little cup of ice cream, whereas exploration and discovery are more like a big, like, you know, chocolate and coffee flavor, you know, one scoop of chocolate, we concentrate on more. So the good thing about ITE1 is that it rips through a lot of things very quickly, but it doesn't cover many of them in very much depth, so you'll find that discovery and that is different in that respect.
Yep, so you're going to get a lot of terms. It's a very rich tasting plate of ice cream.
So ITE1 is try before you buy. Welcome. I don't know why I just thought of that.
And welcome to a very sick item.
ITE1 is the Freedom Scientific Jaws demo of Cavi.
Thanks.
Okay. So, first up, because we actually do have a test question on standards, so pay attention. Luke did a very excellent bit of whole day of research on Module 8 and glossarized it. So if anyone wants that and is not in the folder Please email us and request to that, and it will be sent out to you.
Shouldn't I just put it up?
It's not done yet. He hasn't edited it and done all the stuff, so...
Neither was the curriculum. Does that make a difference?
Well, up to you. But yeah, I mean, I've still got to do Chapter 9 and stuff.
We could put, like, dash draft or dash bits may fall off this on the file name or something. But...
Dash use at your own risk, but it's very good. And he did tons of work on it. So he's got a little bit of a presentation for you guys on standards organizations. Yeah.
All right, well, anyone who has read the chapter, you will have seen there's quite a few different...
And you cut off.
I shouldn't have. Sorry, is that better?
Yeah.
We'll see you.
So far.
Alrighty, sorry. But yes, there's quite a few different standards organizations that do a lot of different things, and I personally found the notes were... at least on the subject of some of them, somewhat unenlightening. So I'll just run through quickly a few of them that are mentioned in the curriculum. First is the CCITT, which is in French, so please excuse my murdering the pronunciation. Comité Consultatif International Téléphonique et Télégraphique, which basically what they do... is they develop standards for international communication. They developed the standard for sending fax documents, and they developed some other standards. I believe they developed V.90 or whatever it's called. They developed other standards anyway for transmitting data over telephone lines at up to 56 kbps.
So they're your modem people.
I want to say V.92, but it could be wrong.
That was actually
unless there's a typo in the curriculum. But yeah, I don't know.
There were
yeah,
both.
It was V90, Drew. There was V90 and there was V92. V92 increased the upstream rate, but we don't care about modems anymore very much.
Indeed, and that's a good thing.
Okay, after 1992, I'm not going to try and say that again, ECITT became the ITU-T, which is the... it became the telephone standardization sector of the ITU, and we'll come to what the ITU is in a second. Okay, the ITU, as I mentioned, is the International Telecommunication Union, specialized agency of the United Nations, actually, which is responsible for information and communication technologies. This organization coordinates the... It organizes the shared global use of the radio spectrum, also promotes international cooperation in assigning satellite orbits, as well as working to improve telecommunications infrastructure in the developing world. As well as this, this particular organization does quite a lot. As well as this, it's also responsible for international standards. ITU also organizes worldwide and regional exhibitions and forums such as the ITU Telecom World. And what these forums do is they bring together representatives of governments as well as the telecommunications and ICT industries to share knowledge and ideas and technology. The ITU is active in quite a diverse range of areas. They include broadband internet, latest generation wireless technologies, aeronautical and maritime navigation, radio astronomy, satellite-based meteorology, which is weather-type stuff, convergence and fixed mobile phone, which I'm not sure what that is, internet access, yeah, data, voice, TV broadcasting, and next generation networks. The ITU was formed on the 17th of May 1865, and it's based in Geneva, and its membership includes 192 member states and around 700 sort of other like associate members and stuff like that. And this information came from Wikipedia, just in case anyone the URL if you want to look that up. Okay, the next one is one we will have heard of. It's the IEEE. That's the International actually, I better look this up. Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. There we go. They, of course, we'd know them because they do quite a lot of standards that we talk about here, ranging from the network stuff, the LAN stuff, through to the wireless standards, and also things like FireWire. They do a lot of standards. It's said on the thing that they've got, I think it's 800 published standards and another 700 under development or something like that. It's quite a lot. It's a non-profit technical professional organisation founded in 1884 of engineers, scientists and students. It has more than 377,000 members in 150 countries. Of course, because of their experience and, I guess, their size, they're a leading authority in technical areas, ranging from computer engineering to biomedical technology and aerospace. The IEEE has over 860 active standards throughout sort of everything they do, but they're best known for standards around the computer and electronics industries. Okay, the next organisation we have here is the ISO, or the International Standards Organisation. This is a non-governmental organisation composed of national standards bodies from over 140 countries. So the ISO is kind of an umbrella organisation, I guess, for all of these national bodies, which tries to get them to agree on stuff. It was established to promote standardisation and its work results in international agreements that are published as international standards. That's all I have on that one. I don't have a lot on that one.
ISO 9660 would be the standard that a lot of you are familiar with.
Yeah, I was thinking that.
Okay, the next one I've got here is the ANSI, at least that's how Jaws pronounces it, A-N-S-I. It's the American National Standards Institute. And just to outline my example from before, they are actually a member of the ISO. So, yeah. This is a private, non-profit organization which administers and coordinates America's voluntary standardization and conformity assessment system. It identifies needs for national standards in both the business and industrial sectors, and then coordinates the development and implementation of these standards. Excuse me. Resolving national standards problems and ensuring effective participation in international standardization. The ANSI don't actually develop standards themselves. What they do is they promote agreement and consensus among qualified groups, so I guess that'd be within the industry. The results, the way they do things, though, results in their acronym being seen on a lot of standards, which I guess makes people think they developed them when all they did was sort of coordinate their development. Okay, the next group or organisation we've got here is the IEC, International Electrotechnical Commission. It's a bit of a mouth. This organisation was founded in 1906 after a conference in 1904 in America. It's charged with preparing and publishing international standards for all electric, electronic, and related technologies. The IEC is formed from over 60 countries. And aims to promote, through its members, international cooperation on questions to electrical technologies such as technology, symbols, measurement, safety, the environment, and performance. The IEC is recognized by the World Trade Organization and is trusted by it to monitor national and regional standards organizations. So, yeah. Agreeing to use the IEC's international standards as the basis for national or regional standards is actually part of the WTO's Technical Barriers to Trade Agreement, which is obviously all that most developed countries have signed. Okay, the next organisation we have here is the IAB, or Internet Architecture Board. Internet Architecture Board, it's an interesting organisation actually. It's the committee charged with oversight of the technical and engineering development of the Internet by the Internet Society, or ISOC, ISOC. We'll get to them in a moment. It oversees a number of task... This is the IAB. Oversees a number of task forces, the most important of which are the IETF and the IRTF, both of which we will also come to presently. The Internet Architecture Board, it was... this one also came from Wikipedia. And it was very interesting researching this, because there was some debate, even within the industry, seemingly, about whether the IAB came from the ISOC, or whether the ISOC came from the IAB, even though one was founded about 10 years before the other. And what I was able to determine was that basically most of these sort of main forces or powerful forces within the Internet are quite loose or informal bodies, like in a, I guess, in a legal sense. Wishy-washy and hard to define what they actually do. So therefore, the ISOC, I believe, came into being sort of as a means of putting a corporate structure behind all of these things for funding and just to, I guess, clean everything up and nice. So therefore, that's where the that's why the debate exists. You know, came first, the chicken or the egg thing. Okay, now, another interesting point. The body which eventually became the IAB, it was created originally by the United States Department of Defense in their Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency with the name Internet Configuration Control Board. During 1979, it was created in 1979. Eventually, it became the Internet Advisory Board during September of 1984, and then the Internet Activities Board during May of 1986. The name was changed, but they kept the same acronym. It finally became the Internet Architecture Board under the ISOC during January of 1992. This was as part of the Internet's transition from a US government entity to a international public entity. Okay, and as I said, that came from Wikipedia. The next one is the ISOC, or ISOC, which is, as I've already said, the Internet Society. This is a non-profit organization. It aims to provide direction in internet-related standards, education, and policy. It provides a corporate structure for the internet standards development process. This, as I mentioned before, became necessary because many of the main forces of the Internet were very informal organizations, and there was no real structure, and there was a growing need for financial support and organizational structure. That also came from Wikipedia. Okay, now we move on to the two task forces under the Internet Architecture Board that I mentioned before. The first of these is the IETF, which is the Internet Engineering Task Force. It is a standards organization which aims to create standards applying to the Internet to improve usability. It's a very informal organization made up of a number of working groups. Now, these working groups have got no formal membership or membership requirements, and people on these working groups, they work just as volunteers, though they're usually funded by their actual employer, whoever that happens to be at the time. There was an example of someone who was the head of one of these working groups who was funded by the National Security Agency, so make of that what you will. These groups are formed on specific topics and are expected to disband once they've achieved what they set out to achieve, but they may be... they may have their charter altered or extended to, you know, to carry on with more work. But generally, they're quite sort of a short-term thing. Unlike the IRTF, it focuses on short-term issues relating to engineering or standards making rather than long-term research. The IETF was formed on January 16, 1986, and that was also from Wikipedia. Okay, the next task force I want to talk about is the IRTF, which is the Internet Research Task Force. Now, this, it's similar, it kind of runs parallel, I guess, to the IETF, because it's made up of a number of groups, again, but instead of being short-term working groups, these are more long-term research groups, and it's responsible, the task force as a whole is responsible for long-term research into the evolution of the internet. It works on topics relating to internet protocols, applications, architecture, and technology, and is made up of individuals rather than representatives of organizations. Which the long-term nature of the research groups provides stability and helps maintain research collaboration and teamwork in exploring research issues. Okay, this also came from Wikipedia. Okay, the next, I think the last, I'm not sure, the next organizations, anyway, there's two in this. It's the TIA and the EIA. These are the Telecommunications Industry Association and Electronics Industries Alliance. I keep going to say association there, but it isn't.
That is usually written American... TIA slash EIA. That's how you're going to see it. So yeah. It'll be written that way if you do see it.
These are two American trade organizations that jointly develop and publish a series of standards relating to structured voice and data wiring for local area networks. This became necessary after 1984, when the telephone industry in America was deregulated. This transferred responsibility for on-premises cabling to the building owner, rather than, because before this, the company, whoever it had been, was it, I don't know how to pronounce it, but basically they used proprietary systems and cables and everything else, so they just did all of it. But after 1984, the industry was deregulated.
AT&T?
Yep, that's them. I didn't actually look at the abbreviation, so I wasn't sure what they were. I thought it was a word. Yeah,
it's the
so
American
before
Telegraph
19...
and Telephone Company is what it stands.
Cheers.
I believe.
But yeah, so before they deregulated the industry, they were responsible for all the cabling for phones and networks and things, including that within a building or, you know, an office complex or whatever. But then when the industry was deregulated, that responsibility was passed to the owner, since they could now choose to go with competitors. And that, everybody, is all of the standards organizations I have written here. So, yeah, if anyone wants either those Wikipedia URLs or the glossary that I was working from here, feel free to email Grace or ask me, and that can be arranged. Thank you very much.
That was a fantastic presentation.
Absolutely.
And
did
in
you
the
say
test,
those would be
only...
available in that folder as well?
It's in the folder, yep.
The test only asks you about one of those organizations, one of those sets of organizations. We're not going to tell you which one because we're nasty. So you need a basic overview.
But they probably
of what
want
they
you
do.
To guess out of these whole bunch of them, which one?
No. It's a question on one of them. They give you the organization and ask what it does. And
okay.
Luke basically gave you word for word the answer somewhere in that presentation.
Okay.
So, yes, that was amazing. And all without a braille display, which is something I could never do. So, absolutely great.
The only
oh, you didn't have
better
one?
Than
yeah,
that
you...
is Drew. And he can just read stuff while it comes up on his jaws because he's a freak, aren't you, Drew? A very clever freak, I might add.
I wouldn't be as good at it if it weren't for my Mac and the ability
I
to
I can't ever do that. Yeah, I can't do it either. I can't listen to a sentence and read at the same time.
NVDA can do that.
I'm okay. Yeah, I think NVDA uses
what?
Shift.
Yes, it does. It uses shift. If you push shift, it pauses. If you push shift, it starts again.
I use it sharp, and I shorten the lines to a length that I can read, and I do it that way.
I cannot do it. Like, I cannot at all. If I had to do it, it would be a mess. I just couldn't do it at all. I can't take spoken word and output it. So if I had to do that, if I had no braille display, your lectures would be complete messes.
I think that's also in Jaws, I think pressing the shift keys let you do your skim reading so you can jump backwards and forwards as it reads as well.
Yeah, that would let you back up and catch something that you missed.
I always use the arrow keys because the shift's all you know, turn on the sticky keys thing, which I know I can turn off. I've just been too lazy.
So whatever, however way you do it, people, if you've got Braille displays, use them. If you don't, you have to be very good at buffering and talking. And surprisingly enough, the first time you do it, you go, bleh, 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 and then after about week six, things get better.
You get used to it.
I cannot do it, so that kudos
I can't
to...
do it on Braille displays, because they move too slowly for me. I can't keep up.
Well, you can move it.
Yeah.
They can't keep up.
Yeah, they can't keep up. Okay, so fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. Yeah. Thank you very, very much.
Anybody else who wants to know what it feels like to be an instructor, feel free to get a little bit of stuff together, and you can have a go too, and you can feel the pressure and excitement and thrill of what it's like to actually present something. We don't know whether that'll be good for you or not, but if you're interested in doing that, we can make that happen.
But beware, I've just learned it's harder than you think it would be.
Oh,
just
yeah.
Prepare. Well, yeah, I did the team talk thing.
You're a whole hour.
And
oh, yeah, you get 2 hours.
I did the team
talk
thing, and things kept going wrong, and I was just having to, like, scramble and come up with.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm going to upload a file, and oh, it broke.
Yeah.
It's really but at least with you, Drew, like, you read the correct articles, for example. I mean, if you write stuff down in a format, you know, write down your lecture in a format that you can read, then you'll be fine.
Drew has an uncanny ability to read anything on an audio stream that is streaming into his ears. It's unreal.
The other thing to mention is, and this is just a mention for anybody who's looking at doing instructing and stuff in the future, do not plan your lectures to a rigid framework and expect nothing to go wrong, as an instructor once did with one of their presentations. Stuff will blow up and go wrong. You have to be adaptable and to deal with any things that may cause that thing to fall over, and you will have something else to move on with. Have some stopgap things where you go, well, we're not uploading files right now, we're going to go on to changing the window color, and then you come back to uploading the files once you have the problem resolved. And that is the mark of a good presenter, one that doesn't sit there for 5 minutes going, I'm sorry. So you get
and that's so hard not to do
that.
It's really hard not to panic. Okay, so we should probably get on to the rest of the lecture now. We don't need the introductory material, so we'll skip it. Networks are systems that are formed by links. For example, websites that link your page to the pages of your friends are social networks. Facebook, Twitter, all that good stuff. We use many networks in our day-to-day lives, including mail delivery systems, telephone systems, public transportation systems, corporate computer networks, and the internet. The networks we will be talking about today are computer networks. A computer data network is a collection of hosts connected by networking devices. A host is any device that sends and receives information on the network. Remember that. That's really important. Peripherals are devices that are connected by hosts. Some things are able to be either a host or a peripheral. A printer can be a peripheral if it is connected to a computer, but if it is hosted directly or hooked directly to a network device, such as a hub, switch, or router, it is a host. Any questions on that? This is a very important concept to understand.
That bit blew my mind right there when I first heard it.
Okay, so...
Like, but how can a printer...
Yeah, so if we have a computer hooked up to... A Ethernet cable plugged into a router. What is that computer? Host or network device?
The computer would be the network device.
No.
The computer is a host.
Think of something that gets infected by a virus and gets big and yellow and... right? It's the host
That'd
of the virus.
Bad.
So in other words, the computer is hosting the network services. And the network services are running on the host.
Imagine if your router got a virus, that'd be awful.
It could possibly happen, too. Your router is going to be a network device. Now, what if I have a hard drive that is plugged into my computer, it's shared out on the network, and everybody can back up their data to that hard drive? Is that a host, a network device, or a peripheral?
Peripheral.
That is a peripheral. That's right. Good job, guys. Network devices, and we'll talk about this again, so this isn't your only shot at it, is a subclass of hosts, of a host, so it is a host. They include hubs, switches, and routers. Network devices take care of network traffic in some way. All right, we'll come back to that in a little while. Networks are used all over the world in homes, businesses, and government agencies. Many networks are linked together using the internet, which is the world's biggest network. What kinds of devices can be connected to networks? Well, I think we've already kind of gone over that, so we won't ask again. Networks can share many different types of resources across a variety of categories. These include services, such as printing or scanning, storage space on a removable drive, such as hard drives or optical drives, applications, such as databases. You can use networks to access information stored on other computers, print documents using shared printers, and synchronize the calendar between your computer and your smartphone. Network devices link together using a variety of connections. We've got copper cabling, which uses electrical signals to transmit data between devices. So that's going to be your standard Ethernet cables, your modem cables, all of that is copper cabling. Fiber optic cabling uses glass or plastic wires, also called fibers, to carry information as light pulses. Has anyone ever felt those little lamps with the tiny little strands that you can feel, and they're supposed to be all different colors? They change colors when you touch them or something like that. If you felt one of those, you were feeling fiber optic cabling. That's kind of what it looks like.
They also have fiber optic Christmas trees, artificial trees, too.
Oh, yeah. They do, they do.
And if you look at actual fiber optic cable, though, if you actually open it up and look at the inside of it, you'll see all those little fibers, but the outside of it is basically a round pipe that's about an inch across, and then if you crack the outer coating, there's this grease that holds the fibers in place, and then they're all wrapped around this sort of ceramic core that runs down the middle of the cable. So it's depending if it's a really big fiber run. So
yeah. That's a feel.
Louis had this thin grease that was like a it was this little stand up thing, and it had this big bundle of fiber optic thing that hooked onto the top, and it would shine a light, and this thing would spin around, and the fibers sort of kind of wave around in a circle, and they could see them.
Psychedelic, whoa,
the light
man.
Going through. Yeah.
I got to feel a cable, or a bit of the shielding of a cable that was part of a pipeline that went from Australia to Guam, and they brought it to an IINet Open Day. And this thing was like, oh gosh, an inch thick of shielding, maybe more. And it was about, 3 inches around. This was some heavy duty cabling, and it was really neat to look at.
It better be good stuff. They didn't want it breaking.
Oh no.
No.
Okay, the other medium. Go ahead, sorry.
On the opposite end of the spectrum, I've got an optical cable that is like it's as thin as like a strand of spaghetti. It's really bizarre.
Well, that's what it looks like on the inside. All these little spaghetti strands are inside of the big, thick, so you've got both.
Also, but what you'd also realize is that spaghetti strand is actually covered by a lot of actual insulation and stuff to strengthen the cable. The actual fiber that goes down the middle that you shine your SP diff signal down is about the thickness of a human hair.
Wow.
Yeah, all of that's protection, yeah.
Okay, the other medium is wireless. This uses radio signals, infrared technology, or satellite transmissions. We'll be coming back to this.
One small point about wireless, which we will come back to. Anybody had any unreliability problems with wireless? Isn't it great?
Never, ever.
That's why, because it's radio waves. Yeah.
Yeah, it's radio waves. It can be interfered with, as we talked about in Module 2.
And usually you'll find people going, I love wireless, I love wireless. And then all of a sudden there's this, and the iPad goes through the patio window because they were, 2 meg off finishing their download and the wireless dropped out.
And there it went. Yeah.
You know what I'm going to do, Grace, since we're talking about wireless, and I'll see if I can have it ready for next week. I'm going to actually, for the guys who haven't heard it before, I'm going to get on this
demo.
Wireless headset and stand in front of the microwave and record it, and these guys can hear what
happens. Yeah, that is a cool little demonstration.
The free talk meets the microwave.
There are many good reasons to network, obviously. Firstly, networks lower cost because computers can share resources. Imagine how expensive it would be if each computer in an office building had to have its own printer and backup drives and scanners. With a network, you can set up two or three printers in a central location, a couple backup drives, or a server to back everything up. When someone prints, the request is sent to a centralized print server, which can send the print job to an idle printer.
It's actually good because if you've actually got an attractive coworker, you can meet the attractive coworker at the shared network printer. This is a great social networking opportunity.
Wow.
You do not have to be trapped in your cubicle. You can see that sexy coworker as they, you know, collect their print jobs.
Absolutely. Wow. Oh, I just happen to be at the printer at the same time you are. You want to go out for coffee?
Yeah, let's go do some more networking.
Yeah, well, that is networking. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Another benefit is increased productivity. A file server gives people easy access to the files they need in a central location. This way, multiple people can have access to files, and finding them takes less time, unless you have an unbelievably unstructured server. Server administrators can completely negate this work, this productivity, by putting files in folder structures that make absolutely no sense.
That's not our server.
No. Files can be shared with everyone or restricted to only those who need to see them. Servers also prevent file duplication and corruption. Document tracking software can be used to prevent users from overwriting files or changing files that others are accessing at the same time. Networks also allow collaboration between users. Collaboration tools include email, forums, chats, and voice and video and instant messaging conversations. A network allows companies to reduce software licensing costs by purchasing site licenses instead of buying licenses for each machine. These licenses can allow the entire organization to use the software or a specific number of people at a time. For example, you can buy a 10-seat license for JAWS. The server keeps track of how many people are using JAWS at any given time. If an 11th person tries to access JAWS, they are told that there is not a seat available for them. As soon as someone unloads JAWS, a seat becomes available if the person were to try again later. JAWS will now load.
I've never actually seen this work.
I think it's $22,000 for a 10-seat license of JAWS.
No, that's unbelievable. Like, you're not saving any money.
No, you're not. You don't actually save any money.
22,000?
Well, it's like 2,200 for the JAWS, because you got to buy the professional, I think, if you want the network license. You can't actually have the home one on the network, so you have to have the professional.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Well, to be fair, who gets the home version and then installs it on a network? You can't, really.
Well,
I mean,
you can't. What? That's the point.
Well, no, think about it. If you have, like, Windows Home Premium, which is considered a home-grade operating system, and you've got, like, five people with Home Premium and the JAWS licenses for that, like, in a community organization, and they've got a little network, you're not going to buy a network license. You're going to look at switching to NVDA, mm-hmm. because nobody's got $23,000,
$23,000. Yeah, well, in that case, most of them would probably just get one copy and then just have one person run at a time.
Yeah.
Well, if you could. We've got a 10-user license here, and the theory is that you will not have 10 JAWS users. You've usually got a whole pile of Zoom Text users that should really be using JAWS, but because we've got a 10-user license, they stick with Zoom Text.
Yeah, we're struggling at work with how to deal with that, because, you know, and it's hard when you have a budget, because you say, okay, we need another copy of JAWS, and they're like, well, wait, no, you've already got two of them, and you have to try and explain to them that unless we want to spend a whole bunch of money to have a network of five, you know, how do we actually make this happen? And we struggle with it.
Really hard to make that all work.
The other thing is things like Office, like even with licenses of Office and stuff, you actually need a license of Office for each computer you're going to run it on. Fancy that. You know, so if you've got four netbooks and three laptops and two desktops, you need 9 licenses of Office. Not that I ever see anybody doing that, but you do. And eventually when they blow up and stop going non-genuine, you suddenly go, but I should only have to buy one copy? No, you actually need to license it for each. And licensing could... You could have an entire two-hour lecture on licensing. We won't. But you do have to be in compliance of your license, and it's very important that you adhere to those licenses. And actually, bits of software that help you do this.
Absolutely. Might be worth doing next week, actually.
Week after next week's...
we have virtual machines.
Oh, okay.
In a week. Yeah, and the thing is, when you're doing stuff with corporate, with any corporation, and I've had people say, but they're my friends. I can just put, you know, pirated software on there. They're not going to care. I'm like, if they ever get audited, you're going to be in so much trouble. And it's quite difficult to convince these people that licensing is really a big deal, and there are times when these businesses will be audited.
You will get audited, and you will be fired. Yeah.
And even though the business owner may say they don't care now, it is your responsibility as a technician to educate them as to why they need to have this genuine software. Because if you don't, it's you and it's them who's going to be out lots of money.
There was a horror story that Chris Legg was telling us about that organization that had the various copy of Norton Antivirus, and I think they have five copies that all expire at different times of the year.
God, yeah.
And you need to keep track of which ones are going to expire and which ones are going to stop updating. And I think he's finally convincing them to go across to like a 5-user license of ACID, which will all expire at the same time, so that you don't have to go, that one's got 47 days and that one's got 26 days and that one's got... It's a nightmare.
See, yeah, if they say they don't care, then it's even worse for you, because...
Oh, yeah, if they do that...
Likely what'll end up happening is that they'll say that they don't care, then you'll put on the pirated software, then they'll get irated, then they'll say, oh my god, pirated software! Fire you, and put you on the hook for all of the profits that they lost.
Yeah.
And they'll never say that, because you don't have it in writing. So you're screwed and owe them a crap ton of money.
You don't ever put pirated software on an organization that you work for's computer unless you are willing to wear that cost.
Or you're in Cuba.
Yeah. Hey, I'm talking about developed countries.
You will never work again.
Okay. With networks, individual users do not need to manage data or devices. A network administrator or administrators are able to change or to manage these things for the entire organization. The user does not have to worry about things like updating, backing up, or securing their individual workstation. This allows them to get more work done. Okay, somebody had a comment?
No, it was me accidentally pressing my shift key.
All right, finally, networks allow for redundancy and load balancing. A network can have more than one server to balance the processing load. On networks, if a server or device fails, some networks are able to automatically use other devices to continue to function. And then they send an email to the administrator and talk about that. All right.
That's pretty.
We're going to talk. Yeah. All right, now we have an activity, so everybody please get into chat, and we are going to go through pros and cons of networking, and your job is to tell me when I read something if it is a pro or a con. So I'll get into chat. All right, everybody is. Fantastic.
So you can type P or C for pro or con.
P or C, or type out pro or con, whatever you want to do. All right. Centralizes backup of data networks. And you are all right, that is a pro. Can be difficult to troubleshoot. And that's right, that is a con. Peripherals can be shared. Oh, that's absolutely right. They
when
have
it works,
to be.
It's supposed to be a pro.
Yeah, when it works. Yeah. Have to be administered. That is a con. Networks allow group access to documents. That must be. I'm going to fix that. And you guys are right, that is a pro.
Grace is just fixing her sensitivity. She'll be right back in a moment. Actually, with a lot of smaller community organizations, one of the problems is that they can't afford to employ a network administrator. And that can be problematic because the network falls apart and horrible things happen. Like there are 6 copies of the spreadsheet.
It's not so cool.
Yeah, I really wish my local blind center would employ me, because then they could have their local tech guy run the note takers, then I could run their computer stuff. He's seriously overworked.
That'd be kind of cool.
All right. Now we're going to start on one of many networking vocabulary lessons. I had a student write to me, and they said, gosh, Module 8 is a lot of dry, acronymic stuff, and, you know, basically a, you know, what in the world is up with that? And yeah, I agree. The way this chapter presents things, it's so many acronyms, so many things that you have to remember, all sorts of vocabulary words. So we are here to try to demystify some of that.
It's probably worth mentioning that if you get into a particular tech field, whether it be medical, computers, music, they all have their jargon. And unfortunately, when you hit a specialized area, like for example, if you're into music and you're going to do a MIDI, you're going to get a MIDI. There's all sorts of MIDI jargon you got to know before your MIDI works. We had a guitar player walk into the music shop and go, oh, I'd like to buy a MIDI. And the guy's like, well, no, you can't actually do that. It's not like that. And the guy's like, but my friend said a MIDI would be really good and I want a MIDI with my guitar. So understanding the jargon is important.
I had a funny one today, actually. I was listening to the Image for Windows thing that Carrie did, and it said a .tbi file, and I didn't think about it. But then when he said terabyte unlimited, I thought, oh, but for a second I was thinking traumatic brain injury, which tells me I've been in rehab far too long.
Yeah.
No, that's when you've used Image for Windows for too long.
Hey. Networks are given different names depending on the area they serve, how data is stored, how resources are managed, how the network is organized, type of networking devices used, and type of media used to connect the devices. Alright, so we're going to go over the different types of networks that you can have. LAN stands for Local Area Network. In the past, the word local referred to the network being contained in a single physical location, such as a home or office building. Now, local refers to the network being under the control of one administrator or group of administrators. A LAN can be spread over miles and miles, as long as it is under one administrative control. Devices in a LAN are usually physically close, but this is not a requirement. Okay, so that is a LAN. A WAN is a network that connects LANs in geographically separate locations. The most common example of a WAN is the Internet. The Internet is a large WAN.
And that stands for Wide Area Network.
Yes. Did not say that.
Because you forgot to... No,
oh,
because
good.
You forgot to explain what it is.
Oh, fantastic. The Internet is a large WAN that is composed of millions of interconnected LANs. Telecommunication service providers are used to interconnect these LANs at different locations. Some very large companies have WANs with different administrators responsible for the individual LANs in a particular location or location. In a traditional LAN, devices are connected using copper cabling. In some environments, cables might not be practical, desirable, or even possible. If this is the case, a WLAN, or wireless area network, or wireless local area network, is going to be used.
Just a small point, though. If you are going to do a wireless network, possibly going through double brick walls and up 6 floors isn't going to happen easily. So do think about that, because wireless does not punch through walls as if they are soggy paper.
No, your WAN can only go so far.
WLAN.
And the farther away you are, the less speed you get and the less reliable your connection will be.
Correctamundo.
Absolutely.
And Jaws says WAN, which kind of cracks me.
Does.
And choose G or N at the start, because if you mix G and N on the same network, then you'll probably bring the whole N stuff down to G speed.
Not necessarily.
No, I don't think it works that way.
That actually depends on the access points, which we're not going to necessarily talk about. It is true, however, that if you would like an extra 20 kilobytes per second, if you turn off G protection and B protection, you can get that little bit more speed out of the wireless. Which means, yes, you can YouTube from the fifth bedroom, if that's what you're doing.
Sometimes you don't have a choice but to run in mixed mode. So if you do have a choice and you can get all G or N devices, then it's a good idea. But if you don't, you don't, and that's life.
What's your sense? Is it G or N?
G.
Ah, okay, so if I turn off G, you won't be able to use your sense. Okay, we
won't
do that.
Yeah, which is not so cool.
Yeah, I was playing with that the other day, and that can cause some big issues for older technologies if you have...
Yeah.
Aren't backwards compatible.
Absolutely.
My dad's laptop's got a B cord hanging out the side.
Oh, man.
Oh, man.
Disgusting.
At least I think it still does.
For long distance. B is actually good for really long distance. So, for example, some friends of ours have got a 23-kilometer wireless link in Melbourne, and it's running B because B is actually really good for long distance stuff. Oh, yeah.
Wow. I wouldn't have thought that would be possible.
That's insanity.
Well, no, they've got repeaters and everything.
No, they don't.
Don't they?
No, it's two parabolic dishes pointed point to point at the tops of poles.
Oh,
it's
okay.
Like a 23 dBi grid pack. There's no repeaters.
Yeah, it's...
So why do you need such a long thing? Is it from, like, home to work or something?
Oh, no. It's just because they can.
Yeah, they're actually giving internet access to people who are out in rural areas that can't get ADSL. So they've actually got, like, a grid pack at the top of a tower doing a multi-point drop to, like, all these people that can't get ADSL. All
right, that's nice.
Hey, wireless devices are used to transmit and receive data using radio waves. Okay, these networks allow you to share files and resources, as well as access the internet just like a LAN. In this type of network, wireless devices connect to an access point when they are in range. The access point is typically the only device that is connected by copper cabling to the LAN. The range, radius and of coverage, for typical WLAN systems varies from under 30 meters, 98.4 feet indoors, to much greater distances outdoors, depending on the technology used. Yeah, 23 kilometers with dishes and crates. All right, time for another activity to make sure you all were paying attention and are awake. All right, so for this activity, your three choices here are LAN, WAN, or WLAN. All right, so... This type of network uses access points and wireless NICs for connectivity. That is going to be a WLAN. Good job. This type of network uses cable connections in a single administrative group. And this is a LAN. All right, this type of network uses many technologies to connect distant networks. WAN, yes, it's a WAN. there you go. These activities might be a little bit insulting to the intelligence, but they keep you awake and make things a little more interesting, I think. Some networks do not have centralized administration. These are called peer-to-peer networks. In this type of network, individual users are responsible for... and can decide which data and devices to share. In this type of network, each device, or irresponsible, has equivalent capabilities and responsibilities. So there is no hierarchy of computers. Peer-to-peer networks are best suited for 10 or fewer computers. There's no need to hire a network administrator for these networks, so they can be good for small businesses. There are several advantages to this network model. There's no centralized network administration, these are disadvantages. I'm sorry, I don't know why. One cell difference. There is no centralized network administration, which makes it difficult to determine who controls resources on the network. There is no centralized security, so each computer must use separate security measures and data protection. The network becomes more complex and difficult to manage as the number of computers increase. There might be no centralized data storage, so you're going to have to do your own backups. Peer-to-peer networks can be set up even if you are on a larger network using servers. Many homes have peer-to-peer networks, and you, being the computer technician that you are, probably have one. If you do not, well, don't despair. You'll get to create one in Chapter 14, I believe. And that's a really fun lab. So it's really quite cool because you get to make your own network. I think it is 15. I don't know why it says 14.
Yeah, 14
we'll fix
is the
that.
Printer one.
Yep, it is 15 where you get to create a peer-to-peer network. That's a really cool lab if you haven't done it already. The other network setup is the client-server model. The client requests files or services from the server, and they, if the client has permission to receive them, the server provides them. The server can do some of the processing work for clients to save on processor workload. I'll tell you about our network that we have at home. We have both a peer-to-peer type of network and a regular client-server network. It's the GOTS network. And our GOTS network has a print server that's kind of busted right now, a mail server, so we get have our own email and we store our own email, and that works. So if our internet goes down, right now your mailing lists go down, and some of your email just kind of disappears into the black void if your ISPs aren't smart enough to send to a backup mail exchange. And we have a file server that stores all of our files, and it backs up our mail caches every hour or so, is it? Or every four hours.
The file server is the mail server, by the way, just so you know.
Yeah, they're on the same thing. We also have a peer-to-peer network, so we share out drives on our computers so that people can drop stuff between computers.
We don't talk about the music
server. I have a question on that, actually. It always says, when you know, of course, when you're sharing the root of a drive, and I've shared several, just because it's an internal network and I trust everybody on it. But what is the whole deal with sharing folders versus the entire roots of drives?
Now, hang on.
Very simple.
Because while it's an internal network, do you have a wireless access point that other people could use? Because that could
no,
be
no,
a
no, 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 no. No, no, the reason okay. it's...
No, it's secured.
No, the problem is...
Well, I was saying, because he was saying, oh, it's an internal network and I trust everybody, and I was just saying, hang on, are you sure?
The other thing is, if you have a virus that goes rogue, and most viruses travel across networks very quickly, do you really want that virus scribbling around in /windows on every one of your machines? Oh, you really shouldn't have shared out the root of that drive, really. Because the virus has just totaled the Windows install and the program files directory on every machine you had networked because you had all the passwords set to 42, because let's face it, who cares about what the password's set to? And the password just used, the virus used the same password on every machine and took them all down. You do have backups, right? Cool. Thought so. It's really important that... It's a bit like saying, well, why don't I leave all the front windows open to my house and I'll just leave, like, the front door unlocked and there'll be a sign that says, please don't nick my stuff. I'm sure everybody will do that.
I actually am having trouble stopping my computer from sharing out my user directory. I would really like it to stop.
We told you how to fix that, and we'll go through it later in detail, because Grace can show you where it is.
I think I fixed it, but I'm not sure.
See, the problem is, when you share out the root of the drive, you share out documents and settings, so you're sharing out the entire user profiles directory, you're sharing out C users, you're sharing out C windows, you're sharing out C program files. All very sensitive system directories. Whereas it could be argued that really you should only be sharing out /mp3, /downloads and actual data. Why do you need to share program files? That makes no sense. And that's why Microsoft hits their head and goes, why do you people do this? I will scream a warning at you and you'll all ignore me anyway. So from an administrator point of view, you've got to go from least privilege to most privilege and say, what do I really need to share? Not, I'm just lazy, right-click, $C, go, baby, go. What do I really need to share?
C dollar
is the hidden share that shares out the C drive by default in Windows XP with administrator access. And we'll just go, oh, /squawky /C dollar. Oh, yeah, documents and settings, loser user, my documents, loserUser.xls. Ah, got it. Why don't you just share out loser user's documentation? With a disclaimer that we do not know of anybody called loser user.
I regularly share the roots of drives, but never the operating system drive.
If you're sharing out an external disk, like if you're sharing out, you know, a music drive or an external drive or a drive that isn't the system drive, it is a calculated risk as to whether you share the root of the drive out or not. and in a lot of the cases it's okay. The other thing you should probably do, to be honest, is unless you're swapping stuff with lots of people, share it out read-only. It's a simple checkbox that will make all the
difference.
Yeah,
I do that as well.
How would you
allow the users to change my files? Uncheck.
No. Share out. Like, if you're sharing out a series of MP3s or something so that you can access them at other places in the house, what I actually do is I have two shares. I have one share that is read-only, so that's like C column, but yeah, MP3. And then I have MP3 admin or whatever, which is a write share. And I tell the music players to only use the read-only share, because let's face it, the music players and stuff don't need to write anything to those shares. It's only you as an admin or somebody pulling in extra content that would actually need to write. So, yeah, create two different shares.
That's a good idea.
Imagine what would happen if your insert age of child decided that they were going to go to the MP3 link on the desktop, and then they were going to hit Control-A-Shift-Delete and watch it delete all of the files off your MP3 drive across the network. Admittedly, it'll take a little while, and the child in question may go, Daddy, what's this progress bar that's going 10%, 20%, 30%? Oh, it's done now. This is just one of the horror stories that you could be exposed to. And not that we've seen this happen, because we usually don't show kids how to delete things, but you'd be surprised how quickly they get it navigating the operating system.
Another thing you might want to think about, if you have children, or have children that could be accessing your network, make sure you think about what you're going to want to share. You might have some things that are more adult that you might not want to have them accessing. So if you're going to have a public share that has no protection on it, which many people do, have a think about what you put up there.
Yes, the same goes for flash drives. As a man found out when he gave the wrong flash drive to a funeral director.
Oh,
to...
yeah.
Yes. Oh, no.
It was very unfortunate. It was very unfortunate funeral material.
It had pictures of young children, perhaps, in...
No, not young children, but adults doing adult things.
Oh, yes.
No,
so
I think
really
it was kiddie porn, actually.
Oh, yes, it was. No. Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
He got arrested for first-degree possession of child porn.
Good.
Yep. So that's really what it comes down to, guys. When you are sharing out, you might think to yourself, look, it's just easier if I share the entire drive out, because I can't be bothered with that pesky permissions dialogue and those silly sharing things.
Your Honor, I present into evidence this room full of people. The prosecution raised.
Yeah.
And this child asking what that picture is of, and why is mommy doing that?
Okay, moving right along, so you get the idea.
I have a question about all that stuff, though, Kerry. If you do share the root of the drive for whatever reason, because you're a goose or whatever, and you do share your program files directory, does that mean that you could run programs from a different machine?
Absolutely
or
not.
Only...
No.
Damn.
Absolutely,
what is on every machine? Have a guess. What's that thing on every machine that everybody is petrified of, and you get into it with that start-run...
System registry.
That's
you need to have the system registry to run any programs. So your setup files are absolutely fine. You can put setup directory of setup files up for people to set up the programs on their own computer, but they have to have the right entries in the registry, and the programs have to be in that certain place for the programs to actually run.
You can actually do network installs of Office, and you can have like the network install over on your file server. But say, for example, you did that at your house, and you happened to be the person who was the file server, and then you shut your machine down, and Jono wanted to load Word. No dice. So, probably not a good idea, unless you've got a machine that's on all the time.
Yeah, but if I went into... if we networked all of our stuff, and I went into Jono's shared, you know, C program files, such and such a super-duper program .exe, and clicked on it on my machine...
It would absolutely... No. No, you'd just see fireworks.
Fun time.
There's absolutely no way
that
would work.
Well, that makes sense, because there's nothing on that computer to tell it how to run. It's all running from another machine.
Yeah, I was just interested in what would actually happen because, yeah.
Well, when you do your lab and network computers,
people have jars running from one machine all over the place.
Yeah, when you do your lab on this and you actually set up a peer-to-peer network, do it and find out.
Yeah, let us know.
Simple programs, portable software such as NVDA or simple programs that have all of their files living in the one directory will likely run happily across the network. But if a program requires to be installed to be used, or it requires registry entries, it will crash and burn. And this is a common question. A lot of people ask.
Yeah, a lot of people want this to work. And it'd be really good if it worked. But programs are so complex that it just won't for a lot of them. Like
The big one is if you've got one copy of Office. Well, I've got one copy of Office. If I share that, everybody can use it, right? Wrong.
Office is a whole.
That's why they make network distributions.
Although you have just told me away, Kerry, that I can get a game to run on my machine, which seemingly won't run on Windows 7. I was very sad.
Try compatibility mode.
Yeah, no, it has a DirectX problem.
This is
no. That's compatibility mode's a really good idea for that.
No. You need the thing from kitchensync.net, which puts in the Visual Basic runtimes that you're missing. I've seen that myself. If you don't, then Duck Hunt from Liam won't work either. So. Get the Windows Vista compatibility pack from kitchensync.net.
I don't have
it. Yeah, that's a good thing.
That fixes GMA Tank Commander anyway.
I didn't think that needed.
It does. At least on some computers. Okay. Any other questions on file sharing over networks? We will play with this in Module 15. All right. In a client-server model, network administrators maintain the servers. They implement data backups, security measures, and control user access to the network resources. It's all automatic, except when a network administrator doesn't know what they're doing and really can't run a network adequately.
A quote from NT Magazine, an NT system can be administered by an idiot, and often is.
Ow. We had a administrator who was horrible word to describe him, he was a internet Nazi, basically. He filtered out everything, so much so that the Daily Living Skills class could not look up recipes for chicken breast. Yeah.
Wow.
So, someone had to march down there and explain to him that this really needed to be changed, or else the poor TLS students were never going to learn. This was at the blind school.
Were you the person who had to march down there and ask and tell him that? I'm one.
No,
well,
I wasn't.
Because I could see it being.
Some of the content filters, we actually had some content filters in the early days that used to trip out on the words wristwatch and Scunthorpe. And we will leave that as an exercise for the student to figure out why wristwatch and Scunthorpe would be words that the content filter would trip out on.
I'll give you a clue. Word search, anybody? So, You take apart those words, and there are words within those words that might have tripped out the sensor.
Hey, at least you knew it was working.
Great!
Yeah, but what cost?
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing is, one of the Catholic schools, the Catholic school system of New South Wales, actually has a system built for them that doesn't block everything. It allows things by inclusion. So you actually go, I will include this website and this many levels deep, and you actually set that up as the include filter. It's not an exclusive.
My favorite was an IRC network that didn't know how to properly set up their filters right, that would was trying to shun people for using certain terms, but they wouldn't do the exclusions. So unfortunately it worked, like if they talked about eating grapes, for example, then all of a sudden they wouldn't be able to talk to the rest of the network, and they wouldn't even realize it had happened. They wouldn't even realize that no one could see them anymore, and it was complete chaos. And they didn't even tell anybody that the policy was in place. It was a complete mess.
Oh, wow. Good.
Oh, man.
You obviously can't go into the help channel and ask what's going on because you're shunned.
Yeah, great.
It was sort of funny because on the dark side, we used to sort of sit around and watch the proxy logs, and I'd like, Who's on machine 57? Oh, that's, you know, Cheryl Smith. Oh, she's just on rsvp.com.au. Oh, yeah, she's single. Yeah, I thought she was looking for a new bloke. And all the IT people would sit around and, like, theorise what everybody was doing at the various different websites.
Wow.
You shouldn't.
Yeah, don't think that doesn't happen at your college, by the way.
No, yeah, it doesn't happen here, no.
No, never, never.
No,
that is amazing.
No, we can't be bothered here. We really don't care.
I just meant in general, like if you go to college or something, your IT department's probably just casually...
Oh, totally. Go ahead, what were you going to say?
Just out of curiosity. Yeah, just out of curiosity. Since I do have a Linux server set up, are there any like content filtering or any content filter software that I'm fine for it?
Really just use OpenDNS.
OpenDNS will filter you at the DNS level, and that tends to be the easiest way to do it. If you want to play with Linux and do it with a SQID proxy and things like Dan's Guardian, those things do exist. I think Squirm is also a fast blocker for SQID. Well, SQIDs obviously squirm around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thank you there. I know. Okay, so the other thing that I was told a story about was that they filtered dirty jokes, and so you wouldn't get them in your email, but the administrators would get them. So the administrators would send around these files of the horribly dirty jokes that people would get in their emails.
Yeah, the first 3 weeks, my friend, they implemented the content filter in council. And this was the Tamworth Council, and I got this, like, 150k text file called profanity.txt, and that was all of the dirty jokes that had tripped the filter that he'd collected together in, like, 3 weeks.
Wow.
That's awesome.
I won't.
Well, at least you'd get them back.
Really?
Oh, no, nobody got them back. They just went to Kerry.
Well, no, they went to my friend, who then, like, collected them all together and sent me this big file. Yes, I still have the file.
No, they didn't see them. Okay. You need a username and password to access the network resources that you are allowed to use. A workgroup is a collection of workstations and servers on a LAN that are designed to communicate and exchange data with one another. Each workstation controls the user accounts, security information, and access to data and resources for that computer. A domain is a group of computers and electronic devices with a common set of rules and procedures, administered as a unit. A domain does not refer to a single location or specific type of network configuration. The computers in a domain are a logical grouping of connected computers that can be located in different locations in the world. A specialized server, called a domain controller, manages all security-related aspects of users and network resources, centralizing security and administration. For data protection, an administrator performs a routine backup of all of the files on the server. If a computer crashes or data is lost, the administrator can easily recover the data from a recent backup. All right. Any questions on that?
I've got a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, backups have saved my butt dozens of times. I was going to do a whole backup of all the stuff at our office, usually on Thursdays, and came in Monday and had to pull stuff out of the backup because files had been lost. So backups are good.
And if you're not sure of how to do a backup, there are a couple of chats that have happened this year. That is the backup chat on how to backup files in all sorts of different ways. Also, you have Image for Windows, which is very good, very accessible, and, you know, relatively easy. So you may want to sit down and listen to those chats because they were very good, and Kerry did an excellent job on those.
There's only one thing more terrifying, and you can actually see the fear in their eyes. There's only, like, there's two stages of fear. The first thing is when the secretary comes up to you and says that they've lost some files, and do you have a backup? Nothing can ever replace the horror when you tell them no. Don't do that. It's not very nice. The other thing is, and we talk about it in the Thursday chat, don't put all of your files onto one external drive. because if it falls off the desk, well...
Oh, yeah, you'd be surprised how many people do that and think they're safe.
Especially since one of mine is currently on the windowsill.
I have a scary story about backups, and this was
putting
just...
it on the windowsill is lunacy.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's about the best place you can put it, and it's already broken anyway, so...
Oh.
So I had to give a final, and I could have sworn that I'd put this these final descriptions up in a certain folder. Well, I had, but we had somebody who was querying us as to what a bunch of files were in this directory. So we sat down, and we deleted a bunch of stuff. And I didn't remember what this file was about, because I had... Oh, no, I think it was the volunteer who had done it, had not labeled it too well. So I'm like, oh, we don't need that anymore, it's old. We can get rid of it. It was the final descriptions for a student that was going to take it in 2 hours. Thankfully, we had rollbacks of that server, so we were just able to roll it back to that time, get the file, I renamed it properly, and it is in the correct location.
No, we didn't roll it back at all.
No,
we do not roll back. We're not that flash, because I don't have thousands of dollars for that technology. We actually went back to the snapshots that were made at that time and took the file from there. So we didn't actually roll the whole server back. There is actually virtual... VMware has some technology like VM Center that can actually roll servers backwards and forwards in time. It's phenomenal. It's like, I want it the way
Whoa.
It was yesterday. And the machine is like it was yesterday. It's amazing technology.
So he was able to at least get that file back, and it was super good, because there was no way I was going to get those descriptions done again in that 2-hour window. All right. So if you think you've had enough vocabulary for today, say something now, and we'll just let you out a half an hour early. Otherwise, you're going to get more vocabulary.
I think we keep going, because it's a big chapter.
I think we do too, but hey, if people are really, really feeling like it's too much...
Well, then they can sign off and come back and pick the recording up. I mean, that's what the recording's for.
Well, in that case, it's time for more, and we're going to talk about bandwidth, which is the amount of data that can be transmitted within a fixed time period. The size of the bandwidth determines the amount of information that can be transmitted at one time. Bandwidth is measured in bits per second and is usually denoted by any of the following units of measure. BPS, which is bits per second, KBPS, which is kilobits per second, KBPS with a capital, or sorry, no, MBPS with a lower capital is megabits per second. A byte, BYTE, is equal to 8 bits and is abbreviated with a capital letter B. 1 megabyte with a capital M is approximately 8 megabits, and that is denoted with a capital M. So capitalization is really important here. When data is sent over a computer network, it is broken up into small chunks called packets. Each packet contains headers. A header is information added to each packet that contains the source and destination of the packet. A header also contains information that describes how to put all of the packets back together again at the destination. So your data is broken up into one big jigsaw puzzle, and you've got to put the computer has to put that jigsaw puzzle back together so that you get your MP3 file. The size of the bandwidth determines the amount of information that can be transmitted. If anyone wants to understand exactly what makes up a packet, there's a really good diagram somewhere in Discovery, and you'll get to learn exactly how a packet is made up and learn how to put one together, learn how exactly it's organized. Really good. Lots of fun. We'll be doing that in Discovery soon here. All right. A bandwidth can be looked at as a highway. An eight-lane highway has the capacity for more cars than a 2-lane country road, because it's just wider and more cars can go through. The same's going to go for your bandwidth. The more you have, the more packets can be accommodated at once. The amount of time it takes data to travel from source to destination is called latency. Data is delayed by network devices and cable length. Network devices add latency when processing and forwarding data. This isn't usually a problem when you're surfing the web or downloading files, but it can be for things like voice chat or streaming video. Data can be simplex, meaning only travels one way. Half duplex, meaning it can only travel one way at one time. Or full duplex, meaning that data can travel both ways at once. Broadband technologies such as DSL and cable operate in full duplex mode. This is why people can people with DSL can download files and talk on the phone at the same time, even though the two technologies are using the same medium. An example of simplex is your radio or TV. It's broadcasting to you. It's only going one way. You're not able to talk back to that FM radio or TV. Half duplex might be... Oh, yeah, but they're wrong.
They think football players will do what they want if they talk to the TV.
Absolutely. Duplex is like a CB radio. You can only get information one way at a time.
I remember half duplex sound cards. It was annoying.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, the other problem was when we had VXD drivers, before we had WDM and we had the kernel mixer, JAWS could talk or you could hear your noises. Not both at once.
Yep, you got JAWS 3.7, yeah. Which made it amazing. And you could suddenly do both.
Interestingly, cool that used soft wave files with software synthesizers box was still around in one of the old, like, JAWS 10 or something. That would actually tell JAWS to stop talking while a wave file was playing.
Oh.
And it wasn't JAWS that fixed the problem, it was actually, JAWS had part of the fix, but if you didn't have a WDM driver, you had no mixing. So you couldn't actually have two sounds playing at once.
Yeah, it was bad. I remember that. Those were the old days of the Windows 95 machine.
I remember when it was a big deal to have a multi-channel sound card. It can play both on accessible chat, and your JAWS can talk, so you hear the little chime when people come in.
At the same time. Of course, I always used external speech, so it didn't bother me, but everybody else was always complaining.
Oh, it was huge.
Then you could play Starfight with it.
Yeah.
God, you're making yourself sound old.
It was just an IRC server, wasn't it?
To be fair, and I wonder if anybody actually knows, what causes songs to Starfight. Be stuffed?
So
be...
did I!
Does anybody know what causes sounds to be chopped off in Windows 7 and Windows XP? Because even on modern machines, you don't always hear the incoming messenger sound, for example. You don't hear them sometimes. They just don't come
out. Yeah, if I'm reading a book in JAWS, I never hear it. Or, well, I hear it with certain people, but with other people, I never hear it, which makes me think
that's
quiet,
where the allow software synthesizers checkbox comes into play.
Yeah.
Is it still in 11?
I don't know if it still even works.
I don't even know.
I bet it doesn't work in 7 anymore.
Where it would static at the end of things.
Yeah. One thing I would suggest with the messenger thing is to make sure that your set my status to busy when I'm in full screen applications is not checked.
Oh yeah, we did all that too, and it still doesn't make the sound.
Messenger does funny things with the volume control.
Yeah, you can blast your messenger. You can blast your messenger sounds.
No, but I've had it mute me. Like, I've had it when I'm talking to people. That's why I don't like using Messenger for voice chatting, because it randomly would mute me. The DeckTalk software synth used to mute my volume control as well.
Odd interactions, but yeah, obviously multi-channel sound cards was something that a lot of blind people were happy about, and kernel mixing was a thing that blind people were happy about. If you're rich enough to own multi-channel sound cards, they sound even better than the kernel mixing, but not many people are.
Like a Delta?
Yep.
All right, here comes the first fun with IP addresses. An IP address is a number used to logically identify each device on a network. Every single host or network device on a network must have an IP address to communicate with devices on the network. Remember, there are two types of devices on a network. Remember, a host is any device that can send or receive information on a network. Now, can someone define a network device? What is a network device?
Switch, router, you know, that kind of thing.
Switch, router, hub. This is something
Mm-hmm. So if you consider a network device a router, it also has an IP.
Yes, it does. It's a host. It is a subclass of hosts.
However, hubs don't.
No. So
that is the exception. Because a hub is a multi-port repeater, it does not need a network. It does not need an IP address unless it is to be managed.
A hub is like a road intersection, while a router is like a gas station at the road intersection that helps the data go manage it better.
Hence why you're going to be an incredible discovery instructor.
You sound terrible.
Yeah. That is an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, that's of course if my lungs stay in my chest, yes.
Oh.
Yeah, you sound like I've been smoking or what. Pass it around.
Well,
oh, I would if I had.
Another way to put it, is the hub is the person that tells everyone else's business but doesn't do anything about their own.
Yes, that is a hub too.
I know a few people like that.
I do too.
So do I moved out this month.
Woohoo! Okay, so these are subclass of hosts. Hubs, which is routers. Hubs don't need IP addresses. That's like the only exception to the rule. Hubs are weird. And you won't see many of them anymore because they've been replaced with switches and routers and all of that good stuff. Now, remember, peripherals do not need an IP address because they are connected through a host. They're a peripheral. They're on the edge. They're hanging off something. No IP address. All devices that want to communicate with each other must have an IP address on the same network. If you wish to communicate with devices on a different network, such as the internet, a router is needed. You can equate an IP address to a person's mailing address because it can change. A network administrator assigns IP addresses much like the government assigns you a mailing address. An IPv4 address consists of a series of 32 binary bits, ones and zeros. It is very difficult for humans to read a binary IP address. For this reason, the 32 bits are grouped into four 8-bit bytes, called octets. An IP address, even in this grouped format, is hard for humans to read, write, and remember. Therefore, each octet is presented in its decimal value, separated by a decimal point, or period. This format is referred to as dotted decimal notation. When a host is configured with an IP address, it is entered as a dotted decimal number, such as 192.168.1.5. Imagine if you had to enter 32-bit binary equivalent of this, which would be 11000000101010. 1000000000001000001. Yeah, see, even I completely got confused as to where I was up
three.
To. Oh, was it?
Yeah, 011 on the end would be dot three.
I think it's 101. I'm sorry, it's 101. See, even I can definitely screw that up.
And you're reading it on a Braille display.
I'm reading it on the Braille display. I just totally lost track of where I was on the display.
Well, I do that.
So
it helps to break it into 8-bit bytes so you can actually.
I was trying to go for 4, but I failed. So.
They're nibbles.
If just one bit were mistyped or misread, just like I did, the address would be different, and the host might not be able to communicate on the network. Unfortunately, we are running out of IPv4 addresses. IPv6 has been developed to alleviate this problem. In the future, when you receive IP addresses from information, you'll get 4 billion IP addresses from your ISP. Now, that is as many IP addresses as the entire IPv4 system has at all for everyone. So you can see why this system was developed. We'll have tons and tons and tons of IP addresses. These IPv6 addresses are 128 bits long and written as 8 blocks of 16 hexadecimal numbers. There are examples in...
No. 8 what? Blocks of 16 bits.
Sorry,
written in hexadecimal.
What did I say?
You said 16
8
hexadecimal
blocks
numbers.
Of six, yeah, okay, sorry. They're written in as hexadecimal numbers.
They're 8 blocks of 4, so you actually get 4 hex digits, colon, 4 hex digits, and that. So 8 fours, 32 numbers, all separated by colons. And that's about all you
great.
Need to know.
So when you so when a tech support person gives you an IP for your router or whatever, it's going to be that much longer.
You won't.
Not.
No, it's going to be more automatic configuration. There's going to be way a lot less setup involved.
the directory services and stuff will hold it in the database so that you do not assign 2A00:4B75:D143:6192:8147 to your router. That will happen from the stuff that actually hands it down. And in the cases where that won't happen, the devices will automatically configure themselves based on their MAC addresses they will use to hash the last part of their IP address. And that's what a link local address was, if anybody ever cared.
When is this going to take into place?
Nobody knows.
Yeah, they're kind of getting ready to implement it. There's going to be a worldwide IPv6 day on June 10th where a lot of servers will turn on IPv6 to see if they can handle it and how it'll go. But this is coming a little bit down the pipeline, but they're starting to get ready for this, and we'll just see how it rolls out. We have run out.
December 1st, 2012 will be IPv6 switchover day.
Right.
I made that up.
No, it'll be December 21 is actually the day when everything blows up, not December 1st.
Yeah.
Well, I said December 21st.
Are gonna blow no, you said December 1st.
No, you didn't.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, the conspiracy theorist is slipping. It was a packet.
It's a Friday. We'll be at Cavi Social.
Okay, so...
I'll be there. Cavi Social to live blog the end of the world.
Yeah.
Okay, nobody will read it, though. The other thing you've got to keep in mind is that Mac OS has IPv6 support. Windows 7 has IPv6 support. Vista has IPv6 support.
Vista does.
Windows XP Post Service Pack 1 has IPv6 support if you do IPv6/install. If you do not know what you're doing with IPv6,
don't
use it.
Does Windows 7 have that, Kerry? Because I went on to this thing the other day, and it said test your IPv6 settings, and it basically said IPv4 is fine, everything's fine, it isn't. So
That's a router, that's your ISP.
Your ISP hasn't given you IPv6 connectivity, so your IPv6 is working but inactive, and unless you want to deal with IPv6 in IPv4 tunneling, and if you want to mess with that, that's in 2007 Thursday Chats directory. We'll see if we can get people to put in for your psychiatric bill if it doesn't work out. You will be able to get IPv6 connectivity.
You don't. You will have so much warning before you even ever have to worry about this.
They'll probably just send you a new router. This is your new IPv6 router. Plug it in. Get on with your life. That's what a lot of ISPs are going to do. It's just going to be no user-serviceable parts inside.
Great.
I know I always ask this question every time we talk about this, but they're going to have dynamic addressing in IPv6, right?
Not...
Yes and no.
Sort of.
You'll have both. I mean, on the bright side, though, your ISP will know exactly what IP addresses you got handed out, so yes, they'll still be able to track you down.
Yeah. I'm fine with the ISP doing it. I mean, they have to. It's totally logical.
Well, the other thing is a lot of applications will want static addresses, so you will have addresses for days and days and days because all of the communications infrastructure will expect you to be end-to-end communicatable and you'll need static addresses. And yes, people will track you down and flood you off the net. They are looking at ways of getting around that, and that's some of the work that's going on at the moment to stop that from being a problem.
This isn't quite nearly ready to fly yet. You have, there are examples of these in your notes, which I'm not going through because a braille display is needed to do them justice. These will blow your mind. They're a bunch of gobbledygook unless you really sit down and have a look at them. It's basically the only information that they give you on IPv6 is how to write them, which is going to do you small good at this point.
What's going to happen to the IPv4 addresses?
They'll be phased out?
Yeah, they'll run for quite a while, so you'll be looking at like 10, maybe 15 years of IPv4 coexisting with IPv6, and they will eventually shut down the entire IPv4 substructure because it won't be needed anymore and everything will have transitioned, and then they'll kill it because there are actually interoperability problems running IPv6 and IPv4 at the same time, so eventually IPv4 will be killed off completely.
So what's that going to do to all existing people with routers?
They will
become... You'll get new ones.
Well, you know, we're looking at like 2020, once we've survived the end of the world. 2020, you will have IPv6 routers.